Hi, I'm Kate Varney. Born and raised in Virginia, I did my undergraduate training at the University of Alabama in athletic training. I went on to get my master's degree in physical therapy and practice manual physical therapy for 5 years before returning to medical school at the Virginia College of Osteopathic Medicine. I'll be joining the Layton Intermountain Family Medicine Group after graduation. So today I'm going to be talking about opioid prescribing among Intermountain family physicians within the urban north region, and I'll define that a little bit later. As a family physician, I wanted to gather data to see what we as family physicians were doing and how we were prescribing these. So I have nothing to disclose. The objectives today will to describe the extent of opioid use, misuse, and abuse, both here locally and on a national level. I'll describe the mortality and morbidity associated with the misuse of these medications. And then last, I'll present data that I collected over the last 3 months showing trends of opioid prescribing among these family physicians. I'll compare these based on practice and gender. So we all know that opioids are psychoactive chemicals that work on the opioid receptors, both centrally and peripherally. This also, there's work in the GI system, which we are aware of because of the side effects associated with these. They decrease a perception to pain, a reaction to pain, and they also increase the person's pain tolerance. Most people that misuse and abuse these, though, are seeking the euphoria side effect. So the beginnings of this epidemic started in the late 1990s. Laws were relaxed. Typically, these medications were used for cancer-type treatment only. We started using these for non-cancer-type pain in the late 1990s. OxyContin was falsely assumed by both the company and the FDA to have low abuse potential. That was due to the extended-release formulation that they initially put out on the market. Patients quickly found their way around this, though, by crushing and chewing these, thereby basically taking this extended-release preparation away. In the 2000, JCO introduced new pain management guidelines. We were supposed to start treating pain better. We weren't doing a good enough job. Pain became the fifth vital sign. Most people believe that this is based on unintentable science and misinformation. There was also a aggressive marketing campaign by pharmaceutical industry for these medications. And we moved away from a paternalistic model of medicine and treated the patient more as a customer. This epidemic will continue to perpetuate itself if we are dependent on patient satisfaction scores for future reimbursement. We all know that when we say no to patients with opioids, they tend not to be happy with us. So people that actually were prescribing opioids for, they actually prefer hydrocodone and oxycodone. Street users prefer stronger methadone. They use and sell this at a higher rate than Percocet, Vicodin, and oxycodone. So this chart represents the misuse and abuse patterns here in the United States. So psychotherapeutics here, you can see 7 million. Makes psychotherapeutics include opioid analgesics. Within this group of 7 million, opioid analgesics were 2 million, and a not-so-close second at 1.2 was tranquilizers. But you can see psychotherapeutics were more than cocaine, hallucinogens, inhalants, and heroines combined. The mean annual direct cost for people who abuse this is higher. Studies have shown that. And the estimated medical, economic, social, and criminal effects of this is estimated at around $50 billion per year. So multiple studies have shown the demographics of opioid misuse. So I listed these here. This article here analyzed the national drug use surveys. And they did this particularly over the last year in 2011. This was published in 2012. One thing, most of these things were well known before. One thing they did identify as a new demographic is post-traumatic stress disorder being a risk factor. So opioids use were made illegal for non-clinical use in 1914. Prior to this, it was used for depression, anxiety. The prison sentencings for illegal possession of these medications is anywhere from 6 months to 25 years based on which state you're in. Utah's a little bit tougher. Your first offense will result in a third-degree felony charge with a recommended minimum of 3 years. You can almost expect the maximum sentencing, though, if you're in a drug-free zone, which is a 1,000-feet radius around a school. On a third or subsequent offense, it's a first-degree felony with a possible lifetime prison sentence here in Utah. So the street value for people that are selling these, diverting these, and selling these on the street range from anywhere to $5 to $100 per pill. So those of you that are prescribing opioids know that it's not uncommon for someone on chronic narcotics to take an opioid, an 80-milligram tablet once a day, and then 2 to 4 hydrocodone for breakthrough pain a day. For a month's supply of this, the street value would be $4,200. So how are they misusing it when they are? They either take it whole, or in order to get more immediate effects, they either crush it or chew it. Some people crush it and snort it like cocaine, and some dissolve it in water and inject it into a vein. These are common mortality morbidities that we are aware of. New studies have shown one new finding was the suppression of the HPG axis. Two new comorbidity concerns that were found in recent studies within the last 2 years. Things that we have seen frequently in our practice, paradoxical opioid-induced hyperalgesia, these people perceive pain at a higher level than people that do not use them. And also blood-borne viruses, which are thought to be because of the IV drug use. A new finding, which is interesting, twofold increase in fracture risk. So the U.S. statistics on drug overdose, around 38,000 annually deaths from drug overdose. A majority of these are from opioids that are legally obtained by patients. We have now surpassed motor vehicle deaths. It's the 11th leading cause in the United States for death, and it's been increasing every year since 2009. A majority of the deaths are at low-dose opioid therapy of 100 morphine equivalent dose. So those of you that aren't familiar with this, one 80-milligram tablet of oxycodone is equal to 160 milligrams morphine equivalent dose. So a new term has been identified in the last several years of dose dumping. So this is when opioids are taken with alcohol. It causes an accelerated absorption of the opioid, thereby increasing the respiratory depression at a faster rate. There are more deaths from opioid overdose than motor vehicle accidents and suicides combined in 20 states. So Utah statistics, poisoning is the number one cause of death, and majority of these are opioids at around 76%. There's an average of 23 per month, and it's more than motor vehicle accidents. 71% of these patients were found to have a substance abuse disorder at the time of the death. A Weber Morgan County Narcotic Task Force agent said that he takes about 75 to 100 cases per year of prescription diversion. So this is the newest and biggest research that has come out in the last several years. So the American Society of Interventional Pain Specialists, the ASIP, studied over 500 different articles, journals, research, trying to find patterns in opioid prescribing and the death and the demographics on these patients. They found that some of their biggest concerns, once opioids are started for acute pain, a majority of these are commenced into the chronic phase, which they define as 90 days. Sales and distribution of opioids has increased. And hydrocodone was the number one prescription in the United States from 2006 to 2011. That's enough hydrocodone to supply every adult American with 5 milligrams every 6 hours for 45 days. Most of these were given for a 2 to 3 week supply, and their biggest concern that they found was 12% of these were given to age 10 through 29, and this is the population most at risk for developing addiction. So even though we as the United States only make up 4.6% of the world's population, we consume 83% of the world's oxycodone and 99% of the world's hydrocodone. You can see here the US, 27.4 million grams annually we use, 3,237 grams for Britain, France, Germany, and Italy combined. So where are they getting this? When they do receive it from a physician, a majority is coming from primary care at 42% for the immediate release. They're concerned about this because people that receive the most training, anesthesiologists and physical medicine and rehabilitation physicians receive the most training in this in their fellowship and residency. Primary care, the least. But yet we are here with long-acting as well, prescribing a majority of these. So when patients are taking these, misusing, diverting, and using these, they're not getting them from a physician. 55% of these are getting them free from a relative or friend. You can see that from a physician, only 17.3% are getting from one doctor. There's poor evidence that opioids are better than placebo in reducing pain and function, and poor evidence that opioids were superior than NSAIDs in relieving pain and function. There's no significant evidence that the long-term pain relief with opioid therapy in chronic non-cancer pain. There's no impact on quality of life. 11 high-quality studies show that they do not improve function or their quality of life. A Denmark study showed that patients on opioid therapy chronically have a higher pain level, they utilize healthcare more, their overall activity level is lower, and the odds of recovering is lower as well. One study even showed that the death rate is 10 times higher for patients taking opioids, suggesting possible harm. So we have to ask ourselves, why are we prescribing these at such large volumes? There's a cardinal principle of medical intervention that there has to be overwhelming evidence of a benefit of a therapy in order to use it on a large scale use. But there's consistent lack of evidence that these decrease pain, improve function, or decrease health care cost overall. So my research was to gather data on opioid prescribing among family physicians, basically to build a base of information, to create further research, to identify prescribing trends in doctors that may need more education on how to prescribe these. My group selection consisted of physicians that were family medicine within the IHC electronic medical database. This included the family medicine residents at McKD. For those of you not familiar with the urban north region, that includes these listed clinics here. The time period was January 1st to December 31st, 2012. And you can see here the medications that were included as a narcotic included in this list. I only included tablet form. It would be too difficult to incorporate fentanyl patches, IV, or liquid forms of these medications. So those were excluded. Family medicine physicians in this area, there's 58 male, 11 female, 18 resident physicians. So the data was reported to me in this fashion. Each individual physician, I received the total number of patients that they saw over that year, the total number of appointments, including their regular clinic and InstaCare clinics, the total number of people receiving a narcotic medication, the number of prescriptions that were written for the narcotic medication, and the total number of tablets that they dispensed. So almost 79,000 patients were seen by this group for about 215,000 appointments. 15,000 individuals received an opioid medication, making up about 20% of these patients. Almost 68,000 prescriptions were given over this time period for opioid analgesics for about 3.6 million tablets. My first comparison was between gender, based on pills prescribed per patient. The female residents at McKD prescribed more than the male residents, but this did not represent a statistical difference. And when I talk about statistical difference here, I'll use a p-value of 0.05. Male attending physicians prescribed more than female attending physicians. This did represent a statistical difference. But all male physicians overall and all female physicians, including attendings and residents, did not represent a statistical difference. One thing that was found was that the more years that you're out of residency, you prescribed more pills. This did represent a statistical difference when I looked at, you had to do it based on a two-mean t-test. I had to get a little creative, but analyzing each of these along the spectrum, there was a statistical difference. So residents actually prescribed more than attendings, but this did not represent a statistical difference. A study from Johns Hopkins in 2012 showed that residents overall have a disproportionate number of patients on long-term opioids, and they have higher rate of aberrant behaviors, including having a urine tox that is positive for illegal substances that they should not be taking. What they concluded was that there was a need for better training and supervision of these residents. One concerning finding was that 5% of these family physicians within this group accounted for 25% of all the opioid pills prescribed among these family physicians. So about four physicians made up 25% of all the pills that were distributed. Two studies have demonstrated this trend well, that few physicians do prescribe a majority of the medications. They found that high volume prescribers have a large impact on the use of opioids and on overdose death. So the summary of my data was that almost 20% of family medicine patients received an opioid analgesic during this time period. Only 5% of the family medicine physicians within this group prescribed 25% of all opioid prescriptions. And the more years that you're out of residency training, you tend to prescribe more opioids. Male family medicine attendings prescribe more opioids than female family medicine attendings. There was no statistical difference found between these groups. So my future research and hope is to examine larger groups to identify physicians that may need more education on pain management. Once we find out who is prescribing these medications, we can focus our education efforts toward them, because physicians in general rate their knowledge and their medical training as unsatisfactory at 71.5% feel that they didn't get a great job during medical school. Veterinarians receive five times more training in pain management than physicians. So how do you compare? Providers should regularly evaluate whether their opioid prescribing patterns match those of their peers. Out-of-the-box prescribing will occur. Opioids are not FDA approved for headaches, but we all have patients and have seen patients on opioids for headache. But if we're going to be prescribing out-of-the-box, we need to do two things: have great justification for it and document well to protect our greatest investment, which is our medical license. We should regularly consult with a pain specialist. Let them be our teachers. Good pain management leads to some reduction in our patients' pain perception and increase of function. And if it does not, we should reevaluate our patients or have them see a pain specialist. And remember that entitlement to good pain control and entitlement to good care are not synonymous.